From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
If the Indonesians say we want to get out of East Timor by June, it is crystal clear now that the people of East Timor don't want Indonesia a single one more day. So Jakarta, if they acknowledge that, if they know that, and maybe that's why they are making this new policy, they acknowledge now, they probably realize now that their policies in East Timor have been totally bankrupt.
Nobel Peace Prize winner José Ramos Horta on the astounding reversal by the Indonesian regime, saying it will consider independence for East Timor. An update on the earthquake in Colombia, and Cesar Chavez is inducted into the Labor Hall of Fame. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Orrin Hatch sees a light at the end of the impeachment trial tunnel. On NBC this morning, the Utah Republican said he thinks it can be wrapped up within 2 weeks. Leaders of both parties will try today to work out a timetable for ending the trial by February 12. The Senate yesterday refused to dismiss impeachment charges against President Clinton and agreed to compel three witnesses, Monica Lewinsky, Vernon Jordan, and Sidney Blumenthal, to give closed-door testimony in his trial. The back-to-back nearly party-line 56 to 44 votes were the first direct indication the Senate does not have the 67 votes needed to convict Clinton and remove him from office. The Senate voted against dismissing the charges of perjury and obstruction of justice and for issuing the subpoenas. Those three will be questioned in closed-door depositions by House prosecutors and White House defense lawyers. After their depositions, senators will vote again on whether to call each of the witnesses to testify in person before the Senate. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin was the only senator to cross party lines on the identical votes, opposing the motion to dismiss the charges and voting for the motion to issue subpoenas to the three witnesses. Feingold was also one of the first senators calling for an independent prosecutor to investigate President Clinton's campaign fundraising. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says the threat of force in Kosovo is essential to bring about an end to the conflict, and Annan's NATO counterpart, Javier Solana, is expected to issue such a treaty today. The United Nations Secretary General spoke to reporters in Brussels this morning after a speech to the North Atlantic Council, the policymaking body of NATO. NATO ambassadors have been working this week on the wording of a threat to the parties involved in the Kosovo conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is scheduled to meet tomorrow in London with other foreign ministers to discuss how to pressure the Yugoslav government to settle its differences with Kosovo's ethnic Albanians. Lawyers for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet said yesterday that torture could not be considered a crime against humanity if committed against terrorists. Pinochet lawyer Claire Montgomery argued that Pinochet's alleged crimes were not crimes against humanity and therefore subject to universal jurisdiction because they were not linked to armed conflict. She said some of his alleged victims may have been, quote, terrorists. A Spanish judge has accused Pinochet of the torture and murder of thousands of people, including some Spaniards, during his 1973 to 1990 rule, and wants Britain to extradite the former dictator to stand trial in Spain. This prompted a member of the panel, Lord Phillips, to ask if there wasn't an Alice in Wonderland quality about international law, because it seemed to him it was much more of a crime against humanity to take actions such as torture and murder, quote, against an unarmed population than one up in arms. Pinochet's alleged victims included political opponents in the previous government and the armed forces, as well as communists, trade unionists, priests, journalists, and doctors who had treated members of outlawed guerrilla groups. Pope John Paul II said Mass before more than 100,000 people at St. Louis's football stadium, appealing to worshipers to reject the death penalty, even for those who commit great evil. The pontiff left for home last night after his 30-hour visit to the United States. Angola admitted UNITA rebels have taken the northern city of Mbanza, Congo, which could serve as a base for attacks on oil wells and diamond mines that provide much of Luanda's revenue. The city is 125 miles from Soyo, the site of a big Texaco installation. A Kenyan Olympics official quit the International Olympic Committee, the fourth member to do so since allegations of corruption in the selection process for host cities surfaced. He was one of six members the panel suspended in its investigation. And King Hussein's doctors confirmed he has had a relapse of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the type of cancer for which the Mayo Clinic treated him for 6 months. Secretary of State Albright is to meet Prince Abdullah, his newly designated heir, in Jordan today. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Astounding news today. Bowing to international pressure, the Indonesian military regime has retreated for the first time in 23 years from its hardline stance on continuing Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. After a prolonged meeting with Indonesian President B.J. Habibie and his cabinet, Foreign Minister Ali Alatas said yesterday Indonesia would grant independence to the East Timorese, quote, if they want their freedom. Independence would be given, he said, if East Timor rejects another proposal that would grant them special status or autonomy. The Indonesian military today backed the government's proposals, with its commander, General Wiranto, stating, if the situation develops in such a way that it allows East Timor to separate with dignity from the Republic of Indonesia, certainly the ABRI, that's the Armed Forces of Indonesia, would respect the decision. Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975. For the next 23 years, they've killed a third of the population, close to 200,000 people, a proportionately larger genocide than what took place in Cambodia under Pol Pot. The announcement has been met with shock, but also caution and skepticism by East Timorese activists. Late last night, I got in touch with the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize winner, José Ramos Horta, at his home in Sydney, Australia, and asked him to respond to the latest news.
Let me say like this. I judge the actions of a government through their deeds, and not through their words. The actions of the Indonesian government on the ground in East Timor in the last few weeks has been of extreme brutality, of savagery. People are being mutilated, women are raped, villages destroyed by the Indonesian army and the hooligans, many of them extremist Muslims, unemployed, organized, armed, trained, financed by the Indonesian military to sow discord and conflict in East Timor so that they can prove to the rest of the world their point that if they leave East Timor, there will be civil war. At the same time, they make a pronouncement in Jakarta saying that they are prepared to accept autonomy, even independence, if that is the wishes of the people of East Timor. I prefer to wait for a few days, a few weeks, before I judge them. On the basis of the record alone, the record of 23 years of the past few weeks in East Timor, I do not trust them one bit. We have been used to dealing with a gang of hooligans, of crooks, of liars who say one thing today and practice something else tomorrow.
Who exactly is doing the killings in East Timor right now, and why has it escalated in the last few weeks?
The actions are mostly carried out by paramilitary groups. These paramilitary groups have been trained, financed by the Indonesian side, by the government, by the army, to do the dirty job because they are overstretched now with problems in many parts of Indonesia. They are are now resorting to civilian militias. Many of them are not even East Timorese, they are Indonesians. Youth gangs of Muslim activists were armed by the Indonesians to persecute the Catholics in East Timor. There is a phobia, there is an anti-Christian, anti-Catholic movement going on in Indonesia today, with churches burned, with Christians murdered, mutilated beyond anyone's belief imagination. And this must be orchestrated by those in Indonesia who are not only anti-Christian, anti-religion, but people with more a political motive rather than a religious motive. And the rumors are that these actions against Christians, against ethnic Chinese, are carried out by loyal supporters of the Suharto dictator to create chaos in Indonesia, to show to the rest of the world and to Indonesian people that under Suharto there was stability, there was order, there was peace, and now Indonesia is sliding into anarchy and chaos. So Suharto must be brought back. That's one speculation.
But now that the Indonesian legislature, B.J. Habibie, the president, Wiranto, the head of the military, is talking about freedom for East Timor, Foreign Minister Ali Alatas, who is the fiercest proponent of repression in East Timor and the occupation, saying if they want freedom, they can have it. Do you see that there's any opening, José Ramos Horta?
Certainly, yes. If there is any change, credit obviously first goes to the determination, the courage, the resilience of the East Timorese, of all generations, of all walks of life for so many years, but also to the solidarity movement that over the years has contributed enormously to keeping this issue alive, to keeping the pressure. A lot of credit goes to our friends in the U.S. Congress, so I appeal to them to keep up the pressure. Because now, if they say that, yes, they are even prepared to accept independence, my question is, are they going to withdraw their troops from East Timor? Are they going to accept a United Nations police force on the ground? Are they going to accept free democratic elections under UN supervision? So what are the conditions for this autonomy they are proposing to take place, and how we are going to ascertain the wishes of the people of East Timor? They say, if the people of East Timor want independence, how are we going to find out this? Are they going to allow a referendum under UN supervision? A referendum to take place must be preceded by withdrawal of Indonesian troops, replacement by a multinational police force. So I ask our friends in the U.S. Congress, I ask the Solidarity Movement to keep up the pressure so that they really accept a referendum under U.N. supervision so that they withdraw their troops from the territory.
What about Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, the Nelson Mandela-like figure for the Timorese? They're saying they will move him from the prison where he currently is in Jakarta to house arrest.
First, I would say, I would ask whether if he's going to move to another prison. Meaning, when they talk about house arrest, does it mean moving him only to another prison with the same conditions as he is now, with restricted access, or they are going to drastically facilitate his contacts with the outside world, in particular with the East Timorese? Are they going to engage him in dialogue? If that's so, then yes, it's a positive step.
Have you gotten any word on what actually the Indonesian regime will do?
No. I go back to what I said earlier, that I judge the Indonesians by their actions. Therefore, I'm still skeptical, cautious. I prefer to wait to see where they are really going to transfer Xanana Gusmao. Are they going to allow him to have an office staff? We would like to supply him with our staff, with our people to help him. We want to look into the place where he is going to stay. Is there security? Who is going to look after him there? All of that. If they facilitate our involvement in the way he is going to be treated, in the way he is going to be looked after, in the way he is going to be supported in this new situation, then fine, it is a show of goodwill, of good faith, and we are prepared to reciprocate likewise.
We're talking to José Ramos Horta, the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize winner. He's from East Timor, responding to the latest news that the Indonesian regime has retreated and bowing to international pressure after 23 years as talking about independence for East Timor. José Ramos Horta, the way the Associated Press Newswire describes what's happening right now in East Timor, they say three people killed over the weekend, 1,500 Timorese villagers taking shelter in the Catholic Church as a result of clashes between pro- and anti-independence groups. Is that how you would describe the two sides?
I would describe this AP story as plain stupid, typical of AP coverage of the situation in East Timor. Very patronizing, very simplistic, what the situation happened in East Timor, as it has been more accurately reported by the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday, is, and as it has been reported by church sources out of East Timor, is Indonesian army arming hooligans, paramilitary groups, which they have been training for several weeks now, and this has been already reported, so I don't know where the AP reporter has been. Probably sunbathing somewhere in Indonesia, and then wake up one day to report on the situation in East Timor.
The dateline is Jakarta.
Well, yes, probably he's been sunbathing somewhere in Java, and suddenly decide to write something about East Timor. I'm very familiar with the stupidity some of the Western journalists, some of the American journalists based in Indonesia. This has been going on for several weeks. It has been amply documented by church and diplomatic sources. It has been amply reported here in Australia as early as yesterday in a major story in the Sydney Morning Herald, blaming the violence in East Timor on Indonesian hooligans trained by the Indonesian army to do the dirty job.
The periodic talks between Portugal and Indonesia under the auspices of the UN are taking place today in New York. Do you have any faith in them?
As often I have said, I have a full confidence in the Secretary General. He and his staff have done a remarkable job under extremely difficult circumstances. That is to say, lack of cooperation on the part of Indonesia that has made these talks so slow, so difficult over the years. Now, with the new momentum created with economic and financial crisis in the region, in Indonesia in particular, with increased international support, particularly from the U.S. Congress and the U.S. administration, the shift in the position of Australia, a historical shift, now also recognizing self-determination for East Timor, all of this certainly is going to facilitate the role of the Secretary General as the peace broker.
José Ramos Horta, why is June 7th the date that the Indonesian military is talking about considering independence for East Timor, June 7th, the national election in Indonesia?
Well, I really don't care about Indonesia elections. I only wish good luck, all the best for the Indonesian democracy movement, for the Indonesian people. The process of East Timor is totally different from whatever goes on in Indonesia, in the sense that whatever act of self-determination or whatever democratic act they want to carry out in East Timor, it has to be separate from the Indonesian June elections. We have to have first withdrawal of Indonesian troops, release of all prisoners. We have to have a United Nations presence in East Timor to conduct a census of the population. We have to have a massive infusion of humanitarian assistance to alleviate the suffering there. All of these in place, then we look into a calendar for elections in East Timor, for a local legislative assembly, and then maybe a referendum in a year or two from now, 3 years from now, to decide the final status of the territory. I prefer a slow, gradual process under UN supervision. If the Indonesians say, we want to get out of East Timor by June, it is crystal clear now that the people of East Timor don't want Indonesia a single one more day. So Jakarta, if they acknowledge that, if they know that, and maybe that's why they are making this new policy, they acknowledge now, they probably realize now that their policies in East Timor have been totally bankrupt. Well, we are pleased, we will be pleased with that acknowledgement. And then give us the sovereign right to do what we want, we believe to be best for the territory. I then would prefer a United Nations transition administration in East Timor, helping these Timorese, preparing these Timorese for the next 3 years, 5 years, until a final resolution of the problem.
José Ramos Horta, Nobel Peace Prize winner, 1996, speaking to us from Sydney, Australia, responding to the latest astounding news that the highest levels of the Indonesian military regime are talking about independence for East Timor. Timor, finally bowing to international pressure. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, you've just heard the latest news out of Indonesia and East Timor. Indonesia, again, has just announced that it is willing to grant independence to East Timor. The government said this yesterday, for the first time since annexing the island territory 23 years ago, an annexation that was never recognized by the United Nations. The announcement has been met with caution and skepticism by East Timor activists, as you just heard from José Ramos Horta speaking to us from Sydney, Australia. But the statement is a major reversal in Indonesia's hardline stance on East Timor, which has endured a genocide. About one-third of the population killed over the last two decades. We're joined right now in New York by Alan Nairn. He's a journalist and human rights activist. Alan and I went to East Timor in 1990, went back in 1991, where we witnessed the Indonesian military open fire on Timorese, killing more than 250 of them. Alan had his skull fractured by the Indonesian military during that massacre as they used their USM-16s against the Timorese population. And then we went back in 1994 when President Clinton went to visit with the dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, and for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. Alan went back this past year to hold a news conference in Indonesia about the fact that the United States, despite a congressional ban on military training aid to Indonesia, that the U.S. Pentagon was continuing to train the Red Berets of the Indonesian military, the special forces, the Kopassus forces, known for their terrorizing of both the Indonesian population as well as the East Timorese. After that news conference, he was deported back to the United States and continues to work on the issue of East Timor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan Nairn. Alan, are you with us? We're just trying to get Alan Nairn on the line with us, speaking to us from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Alan, what is your response to the latest news from Indonesia?
Well, I think this is the beginning of the end of the occupation. Finally, the Indonesian military regime is breaking. The Timorese were invaded in 75, saw families and villages massacred. They didn't give in. in 91 at the Dili massacre, right in the middle of the capital city, in front of the church cemetery. The army gunned down many of the young leaders of the Timorese underground, hundreds just lying there on the road. You know, they either pitched the bodies into the sea or into mass graves. To this day, nobody outside the Indonesian army has been able to learn the truth. It looked like a very grim, maybe even hopeless moment for the Timorese. The year after that, in 92, Shinano Gushmao, the leader of the resistance, was captured. In the first moments of his capture, it wasn't clear whether he would live. There was a lot of fear that he would be executed. There have been so many moments over the years when it looked as if the Timorese might have been crushed or defeated, but they never gave up. And in the years since the 91 massacre, a grassroots movement has arisen internationally, particularly here in the U.S. With the East Timor Action Network. And that movement, you know, through that movement, we've been able to press the U.S. Congress against a recalcitrant executive branch, first under Bush and now under Clinton, to cut back some of the weapons, some of the training to the Indonesian army. And now that army, which is fighting for its own survival as the ruler of Indonesia, you know, this is a regime that is not sure it's going to survive the year intact because it's facing a slow-motion popular uprising within Indonesia itself. Now, as something of a desperation move, I think as part of an attempt to survive within Indonesia, they're cutting loose Timor, or they're in the process of cutting loose Timor. And it's really, I think this is the big breakthrough. There will be a lot that will happen between now and the time that Timor gains self-determination and likely independence. There'll probably be a lot more bloodshed. In fact, I think the killings by the Jakarta ABRI-backed paramilitaries will increase in the coming weeks and months. But it seems inevitable now, absolutely unavoidable, that the Timorese will gain their self-determination, and the overwhelming sentiment in Timor is for independence. What's urgent now is to make it happen quickly and to try to disarm the repressive forces, get them out of Timor, cut off their international weapon supplies, cut off their international training. So on the way to independence for Timor, they don't kill and torture more of the population. And likewise, so the Indonesian democracy movement on the ground will have a real chance to topple the ABRI from power
and
armed forces.
And in just a second, Alan, we will talk about what the U.S. does in terms of providing that military flow to Indonesia. But we have to break for a few seconds. Alan Nairn is our guest, freelance journalist, human rights activist, has been to Indonesia four times, to East Timor three. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! We are still talking to Alan Nairn, journalist and human rights activist who has for years been working on the issue of East Timor, occupied by Indonesia for the last 23 years, now moving on 24, as the Indonesian military has killed a third of the population through forced starvation and massacre, close to 200,000 people, proportionally worse than Pol Pot committed against his own people, the genocide in Cambodia. Alan Nairn, what about the U.S. relationship to Indonesia and what you think has to happen right now? As even the latest news, the Indonesian Armed Forces Commander, General Wiranto, said today, the military supports the government's suggestion that East Timor be given independence.
Well, the military is the government. It's very interesting that the announcement, the initial announcement that they were going to cut loose Timor if the Timorese didn't accept autonomy, the initial announcement was made by the information minister of the government, General Yunus Yosfia, who himself was one of the commanders in Timor at the time of the 75 invasion, and who has been implicated in the murder of an Australian TV crew, a particularly gruesome execution that reportedly involved hacking off their genitals and so on. And he was the one who made the initial announcement, and then the follow-up announcement was made by the foreign minister, Alatas, who has been one of the most hardline figures in the Indonesian government for years and years. He's the one who led the damage control campaign after the Dili massacre, and he came to Washington to the National Press Club, and he went to the Canadian Parliament, and he went all over the world lying about what had happened in the massacre, saying that the Timorese had attacked Indonesian troops. And now here is Alatas joining with Yosvia, announcing that the Timorese can have their freedom.
It's interesting, Alan, it's interesting that Ali Alatas in his statement said, "We have gained no economic benefit from the 23 years we're in East Timor. I could only think that repression is very expensive."
Yeah, there are no truly reliable figures, but as far as anybody can tell, it probably did cost them a lot. They have gained the offshore oil of the East Timorese, which the Indonesian government has been stealing by means of a treaty with the government of Australia. This is offshore oil that, under international law, would belong to the Timorese. The Indonesian government has been dividing up the proceeds with the government of Australia after letting it out to foreign multinationals. But most likely they've spent even more on maintaining their troops and maintaining the occupation within Timor. Figures, documents leaked out of the Indonesian army for the month of October indicate that they had at least 23,000 troops and associated personnel there. But you asked earlier about the U.S. role. The U.S. okayed the invasion at the start. President Ford and Henry Kissinger personally gave the green light, immediately doubled military aid. The U.S., through its then ambassador, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, at the U.N., blocked the U.N. Security Council from taking any enforcement action. Every administration after that continued to arm the occupation. Carter, in particular, sent in planes and helicopters that they used to bomb the Timorese out of the hills and put them in resettlement camps where they withheld food and did mass executions. It started to change, though, after the Dili massacre as a result of grassroots pressure transmitted through the Congress. In 92, Congress cut off IMET military training aid for Indonesia. This is a program that brought Indonesian officers to the U.S. To study at U.S. Military bases. Then after that, we were able to win a blockage of the F-5 fighter sale, a ban on small arms sales, blocking an F-16 fighter plane deal, banning the sale of helicopter-mounted weapons, banning the sale of armored vehicles and tanks, banning the use of U.S. weapons, in new U.S. weapons in East Timor. And then just this past year, both houses of the Congress affirmed support for a U.N.-supervised referendum in East Timor. Now, all of these victories, which had huge impact in Jakarta and really shook the confidence of the Indonesian military, and I think helped to was one of the elements that helped to clear the way for the downfall of Suharto and the ongoing retreat of the ABRI in Indonesian politics. All of this was done against the will of the U.S. executive branch. It's actually a case study in successful grassroots activism, because people mobilized over time and put pressure on members of Congress. These victories have been won, and it's a continuing battle. ETAN, the East Timor Action Network, will be working very hard this year, for example, to try to put through a bill sponsored by Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey and Representative Lane Evans, and that had earlier been backed by Representative Nita Lowy, that will cut off formally all military training programs for Indonesia, and will also have the effect of cutting off the training programs for similar repressive regimes elsewhere in the world. the U.S. for this fiscal year is due to sell $106 million in weapons to the Indonesian armed forces. Representative Cynthia McKinney had a bill last year that would block that and block spare parts and ammunition sales. That is sure to be revived. The U.S. Export-Import Bank, using American taxpayers' money, has in the past been financing the sale to Indonesia of U.S. military helicopters. There will probably be an effort in the Congress to block those kinds of deals. And this is really the decisive moment for Timor, but especially for Indonesia, because in the period between now and the June elections, if demonstrations on the ground in Timor and Indonesia continue, and people continue to come out in the streets and challenge the Indonesian military, as particularly the youth and students in Indonesia have been doing, there is a chance that the power of this military can be broken, that concessions like the beginning retreat from Timor can continue and intensify. But if it doesn't happen before the June elections, there's a chance that ABRI will be able to consolidate their power after that. So this is really the crucial time. And if we can cut off more of the U.S. support, that will make a huge contribution to those who are fighting for democracy in Indonesia and self-determination in Timor.
Alan Aaron, I want to ask you a question which relates to two issues. This, Indonesia and what's happening in East Timor right now, this astounding news of bowing to international pressure. It may be that Indonesia does grant independence to East Timor. And also what's happening in Washington, D.C., the impeachment of President Clinton. The latest news we have out of the State Department, the U.S. is hailing Indonesia's willingness to consider independence for Timor, but says it's waiting for further details. A State Department spokesman says the new Indonesian policy appears to explicitly give the people of East Timor a direct role in deciding Timor's future. As such, it's a positive development, but then goes on to stress there are many unknowns, like what is the plan for consulting the people of Timor or the means by which the people of Timor will be asked to consider the latest proposal. You just documented the long, complicit history of the U.S. government with the Indonesian regime, and particularly the Clinton administration that we're in now. What do you see as a critic of the Clinton administration in this area when you look at the impeachment trial of President Clinton and where progressives stand on his position?
Well, it's just disgraceful the way progressives have been rallying to Clinton. I mean, it's a little hard to think about the whole impeachment issue. Whenever you start to think of it, your brain kind of turns to jelly. It's hard to say anything important about it. But I think one thing you can say is that there's been just horrible damage by the fact that liberals and progressives, especially in Washington and around Washington, have rallied to the support of Clinton, the man who gutted the child support, well, AFDC child support programs, the man who has pursued this really criminal embargo on Iraq, which has killed more than 500,000 Iraqis, the man who is a staunch supporter of the NAFTA, GATT international trade regime, and has tried to ram through fast track, wants to expand this to South America and elsewhere. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, you hear women's groups saying about Clinton, well, yes, you know, he has this sex scandal, but he has such a good record on women, a good record on women. It's mainly women who are the victims of the welfare cutbacks. It's mainly women who make up those 500,000 who have died in Iraq as a result of the Clinton embargo. You see a lot of the African-American members of Congress rallying around Clinton. I mean, this is Clinton. This is the Clinton who, continuing and intensifying the policy of Bush, backed the FRAP in Haiti, which did assassinations of popular group leaders, which specialized in torture and mutilation activists who stood up for the right to get rid of a terrorist army and earn more than 20 cents a day in a factory. And now suddenly it's a liberal, progressive cause to defend this man. I think, in my personal opinion, I think he does deserve to be impeached. I think he deserves to be in jail, not for these, you know, the sex nonsense, but for the crimes against humanity that he has been accomplice to through the provision of arms, through the provision of training, through imposing the embargo on an international scale. And politically, he certainly deserves repudiation for what he's done to undermine American jobs and poor people with his trade and welfare policies.
Well, Alan, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And if you have the phone number of the East Timor Action Network, Alan Nairn has been our guest, journalist and human rights activist who's worked extensively on the issue of East Timor and Indonesia, as well as Haiti, Guatemala, El Salvador, and poverty here at home. Do you have the ETAN number?
You can reach the East Timor Action Network at 914-428-7299, 914-428-7299. There's also a website, ETAN, E-T-A-N, dot O-R-G.
That's ETAN dot O-R-G. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. He was the voice of thousands of migrant workers throughout the United States, leading a movement of farm workers who labored under unspeakable conditions and relentless discrimination. Under his leadership, migrant farm laborers in the United States won recognition, improved working conditions, and a sense of dignity. Cesar Chavez, leader of the United Farm Workers and one of this country's most renowned and electrifying labor leaders, will be formally inducted into the Labor Hall of Fame at the U.S. Department of Labor today here in Washington, D.C. He died in 1993, but he is survived by many. Today, we're joined by Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, and by Richard Chavez, Cesar's brother. They're both here in Washington to attend the ceremonies at the Labor Hall of Fame. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Oh, hi.
That's good to have you both. Let me begin with Richard Chavez. Your thoughts today as your brother goes into this Hall of Fame.
Well, obviously, we're very proud, and we're honored that this is happening, and we're looking forward to a beautiful program tonight, and we'll be there to make the best of it.
Dolores Huerta, for listeners who perhaps are young and, believe it or not, maybe haven't heard of Cesar Chavez, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of his significance and in this country?
Well, I think Cesar proved that working people, poor people, voiceless people can make incredible changes by coming together and organizing. And, of course, this is what he did as a migrant worker who never went to high school. He was able to bring people together so that today we have a union of farm workers that is represented in Florida, Texas, California, Washington State, and Arizona also. And that, you know, we were able to get union contracts, give workers a medical plan. We have 26,000 farm workers under union contracts. We have a major medical plan that the growers have to pay for. We have 2,000 farm workers that get pensions. We have a radio station network. We have housing, over 2,000 homes that have been built for farm workers. And this was all done because Cesar, it was incredible bravery and incredible vision and courage. and faith in himself and in people that we can make these incredible changes, but we have to need to organize, we need to work together, and not be afraid to do things, basically, be active.
We went to the UFW website, and before we talk about what's happening today and the issues you're confronting today, for example, like the citrus freeze in California, we found the picture of Cesar Chavez and his story about how Cesar Estrada Chavez was born in Yuma, Arizona in 1927, March 31st. And were you, Richard, his older or younger brother?
I was next to him. I was younger.
You were younger. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
It's five of us all together.
So you were born in Yuma, Arizona as well?
Yes.
And lived there for a period of time. In 1938, Cesar and his family moved to California. Were you a part of that move?
Oh, yes, yes.
And you lived in the barrio called Sal Si Puedes, Get Out If You Can?
That's in San Jose, that's right.
Were you able to get out?
Sometimes we couldn't. When it rained a lot, we couldn't get out.
Well, in 1944, when Cesar Chavez was about, 17 years old, he joined the Navy, served 2 years in addition to discrimination, experienced strict regimentation, got married, and in 1962, Cesar Chavez, along with Dolores Huerta, founded the National Farm Workers Association. By 1970, the UFW got grape growers to accept union contracts that effectively organized most of the industry at one point in time, claiming 50,000 dues-paying members. And you went on to the famous grape strikes that many people know about. In 1968, Cesar Chavez went on to a water-only 25-day fast. He became well-known for these fasts, repeated the fast in 72 for 24 days. In 1988, for 36 days, said farm workers everywhere are angry and worried that we can't win without violence. And he said he wanted to prove it before through persistence, hard work, faith, and willingness to sacrifice, said we can win and keep our own self-respect and build a great union. Now the struggle continues as you take on the issue of the citrus freeze. Can you let our listeners know around the country what is happening with oranges in California?
Well, we have about 14,000 farm workers who are currently out of work because of this freeze. And they have, as you know, the Department of Agriculture has declared a disaster so that the growers themselves are able to get assistance, low-interest loans, et cetera. But the farm workers themselves, there's no criteria for them, so we're struggling to try to get some kind of help for the farm workers. We've been able to get some kind of food, and Department of Labor had some leftover money from the flood disaster relief, about $1 million, but that's not going to be enough to get, you know, keep these people working between now and July.
So you're saying the growers got government subsidies, but the workers are sort of hung out to dry.
Right, and then we're trying to get the president to declare it a national disaster so that they can make some FEMA funds available. And, you know, we're struggling with that because the president has not declared it a national disaster yet, although Governor Davis has asked, you know, for a disaster to be declared.
Does it make a difference for farm workers having the new governor, Gray Davis?
Well, that's kind of our hope. He mentioned a little while ago that actually we're closer to 100,000 farm workers under union contracts, and we were devastated by 16 years of Republican rule where the agricultural labor relations law was not enforced in any way. And so farm workers have, you know, we've had a very, very hard time. And I just also want to add that, you know, in terms of the history of the farm workers, I mentioned that organizing has kept us alive in terms of the farm worker organizing, but also all of those people out there that have supported the grape boycott, the lettuce boycott, our whole struggle against the use of pesticides, and currently the Gallo boycott, which we have going on right now against Gallo Sonoma Wines. So we want to just thank all the listeners out there.
Explain the Gallo Sonoma boycott, Gallo Wines.
Well, Gallo is, you know, a private company. They're a major Fortune 500 company, very, very big, the largest winemaker in the world. And their workers up in the Santa Rosa area voted over 5 years ago for the union. And Gallo has refused to sign contracts. And they've really punished the workers that voted for the union. A lot of them have had to leave because of constant pressure from the company. And you would think that this major rich company would have no qualms about signing a contract. And this, but I just need to say this, that we wonder if people like Gallo that have contracts with Teamsters Union and glass bottle blowers, okay, why not their farm workers? You know, it's the kind of the whole racism thing that Cesar had to fight. You know, when we started the union, Cesar said, we won't see a union in our lifetime because the growers are too rich, they're too powerful, and they're too racist. And that kind of comes down to that because some of these same agribusiness corporations that have no problems with signing a contract with the Teamsters Union will not sign a contract with their farm workers because they are the wrong color, in their opinion. You know.
Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union and Movement, along with Cesar Chavez, who is being inducted into the U.S. Department of Labor Hall of Fame today. We're also joined by Richard Chavez, who is the brother of Cesar Chavez. Let me ask you, Richard Chavez, as we talk about the current struggle today, and you've watched it from the very beginning and been a part of it, what gave Cesar Chavez his strength to go on? Just a little while ago, I described the hunger fast that he went on, very debilitated by those physically, if not strengthened spiritually. What do you think your brother had within him that enabled him to go on?
Well, I think it started early on. We were farm workers, and so we started doing the crops since Cesar was about 11 years old, and I was about 9 or even younger than that. And so we picked everything under the sun, I usually say, except pockets, you know. So we knew about work, and then we grew up and became men, and then got married, and we still were doing farm work, and we found it very hard to support our young families on what we were making. And we used to work together all the time, used to say, you know, somebody had to do something about this. It's not right, not knowing that he would be the one later years to do something about it. And so he got his commitment to do something about it early on, you know.
What do you think propelled him to become a leader of the movement?
I think his he wanted to see farm workers do better. I think that's what gave him the strength, because he knew that it was really, really unjust what was happening to the farm workers with the conditions and so forth. And I think that gave him the strength to do something about it.
In 1962, he and Dolores Huerta founded the National Farm Workers Association. But you're describing him being with you in the field, saying this isn't right, someone should do something about it. Was there a moment of transformation? What propelled him to go from being an angry worker and wanting justice to becoming the leader who led so many of you for so many years?
Probably the being in the community service organization had something to do with it. That's what really started it. I think that gave him the a way of starting his organization. See, he learned a lot during the, but it wasn't organizing farm workers, it was organizing the community, like bringing street lights and sidewalks and curbs and gutters and so forth. But that wasn't enough. He wanted to do something for the worker.
And Dolores Huerta, what about you? How did you end up meeting Cesar Chavez and together founding this quite remarkable movement?
Well, the person who was responsible for both Cesar and myself getting involved was a really great person named Fred Ross, Sr. And Fred Ross was the organizer for the Community Service Organization. He got Cesar involved in San Jose and got me involved in Stockton, California. And that's where Cesar and I met. And, of course, what we had in common was this great desire to do something about farm workers. I was working a lot with the farm workers. During those days, they had the guest worker program, and there were a lot of farm workers that were hurt and couldn't get any help from anybody. And the conditions were just atrocious. And that's basically it. But it's learning, and I think this is once people learn how to organize and make changes, and then we have people out there, you know, people like the Cesar Chavez of the world, that once they learn how to do this, then you get this incredible, you know, feeling of, hey, we can do it. You know, we can do it if we work together. And, he's just a very unique human being. I might add, too, that both Richard and Cesar come from a very, very strong family. Their mother, Juana Estrada Chavez, was an incredibly strong woman. And, you know, they just this kind of courage was kind of a thing that very unique for Cesar. But I know that often we would talk about, you know, how we got into organizing, that Fred Ross was definitely one person that was responsible, because he showed us, gave us those organizing skills. And I might add that throughout the years in the United Farm Workers, a lot of people that have worked with us have now gone on to bigger and better things, and many of our graduates, so to speak, are very much involved in the labor movement. in many, many aspects. And I could just gonna give you like a who's who list of labor of people that came out of the United Farm Workers. And I do hope that a lot of people join us today. You know, people that are in the Washington area, we're going to be at the Francis Perkins Building at 4 o'clock. That's at 200 Constitution Avenue. And the it's off the red line at Judiciary Square. That's at 4 o'clock today to do this great moment when CSER will be inducted into the Labor Hall of Fame.
And finally, Richard Chavez, as you come across the country to celebrate your brother and to see him in this Hall of Fame, what are your final thoughts today?
Well, it's a great thing that's happening here in Washington today. We're, like I mentioned before, we're very happy that it's happening, and we're honored from all the Chavez family, that the ones that couldn't make it, daughters and sons and people that couldn't, his wife couldn't make it. We just want to thank each and everyone that's involved for this happening here today, and we're very happy and we're very proud to be here today to celebrate.
If people want to get in touch with the farm workers, where can they call or go to on the web?
Well, we do have a website, and it's ufw.org, www.ufw.org. And also, we're in the AFL-CIO building in Washington, D.C., at the 637-5000. People can call us there. And also, through any central labor council throughout the country, I know that you have many listeners throughout the United States, that any central labor council can give them our information, the United Farm Workers.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us again. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, and Richard Chavez, brother of CSER Chavez, also deeply involved with the United Farm Workers.
And Amy, I just want to add to everybody out there that we are still very much involved with the Strawberry Campaign, and we want people to continue to remind their grocers to please support the Strawberry Workers' Right to Organize, because we have had a very big struggle there.
And how do grocers do that?
Well, they do that by contacting the strawberry growers and saying to them, you need to, you know, give your workers the right to organize, the right to, you know, clean sanitary fields out there with the porta-johns, et cetera, and to keep them free from sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, and pesticides. It's very important. You'd be surprised. They do listen. So we've gotten some support from retailers, but we have to keep reminding them that the farm workers, especially the strawberry workers, need to have the right to organize.
Well, again, thank you so much for being with us. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion with Stephanie Dani. Our engineer is Joe Gill in Washington, D.C. In New York, our technical director is Errol Maitland. Coming up on the next few programs of Democracy Now!, among other things, we will bring you an update on the Columbia earthquake. We'll also be talking to Sean Sellers, who, if executed next Thursday as planned, would be the youngest person ever to have committed a crime at the age of 16, who was given the death penalty. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, today from Washington, D.C., Pacifica Station WPFW. Thanks for listening.